Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another episode in the Berlinale series. I am about halfway through, I guess, but I've been slowly accumulating films to discuss for you, the listeners, for your edification. And who better to join me on this journey but Jonathan Romney. Hello.
Hello again.
We were just talking about how, at this point, things start catching up with you. Just the kind of long nights of writing deadlines and very packed days. But did you have any general things you wanted to say about the festival?
Well, yeah, it's funny because you use the word edification, and I do sometimes identify Berlin with edification. You know, the idea that it's a kind of broccoli festival sometimes, the idea that it will actually be very good for you, but that you may not get that euphoric rush of cinema that you get from certain festivals. And, you know, at the moment, this is an issue because I think in many ways people feel that a festival like Berlin, which has historically been very political, should be primarily addressing the state of the world rather than the state of cinema or the pleasure of cinema. And I think, in fact, I get the sense that probably quite a few critics and quite a few filmmakers may actually feel guilty about the idea that, you know, at a time when the world is so fraught, we're chasing, you know, mere cinematic thrills. I was reading the other day about the Ukrainian writer Sergei Korkov, who said that, you know, in the current state of things, he had not been able to write fiction. And there is that sense. And I think Berlin films have often been attended over the years by a certain kind of guilt, maybe, or puritanism towards, you know, the idea of cinema as being in any way not responsible. But this year there is quite a lot of responsible cinema, and to be honest, that sort of political and ethical responsibility may actually be what we need at the moment.
Well, I guess also there are some filmmakers who aren't here at all who had films that were selected and are boycotting. I think there are handful. I mean, maybe not as many as they hoped, but yeah, that's an ongoing thing. But I guess maybe a good film for us to start off with then is a film that is in the thick of it in terms of at least one of the issues facing us now. That's No Other Land, which is a documentary by Collective, I guess an Israeli-Palestinian collective of filmmakers, two of whom are featured in the film.
Bazel Adra and Hamdan Balal. And then Yuval Abraham, who is an Israeli journalist who appears in the film covering the issues that it's about, covering the events, and the cinematographer Rachel Zor.
And it's set in Masafriyata, which is
on the West Bank.
On the West Bank. There are a number of Palestinian villages, and basically the movie is chronicling over the past few years the incursions by the IDF. You know, the area was declared a military training zone, which was later revealed to be a way to cease expansion of Palestinian villages there. And so this is just a chronicle of that struggle, which involves bulldozing of schools, bulldozing of houses. And one of the members of the collective, Bazel, he is a son of an activist, and so has grown up seeing this happen. And he himself is like an on-the-ground videographer. And I think he provides, I don't know if it's majority or not, but like one of the two main sources of the images we see. And it goes up right to the point of October 7th. What did you think of the film?
I thought it was very powerful. It's very eye-opening, disturbing. I mean, I've seen and reviewed a number of films in the last few years about these issues, sometimes by Palestinian filmmakers, sometimes by Israeli filmmakers. And, you know, of course, this is made by a collective of four from both communities. You know, what's really interesting, I think, you know, in over the years, people have been arguing about the idea of a cultural boycott, which would include academics, Israeli artists, Israeli filmmakers. You know, what's really striking is that if you stop Israeli filmmakers, for example, getting out into to the wider world, you are actually silencing these dissenting voices, because I have not, I think, seen a single Israeli film over the last year that hasn't been deeply critical of Israeli government policy. So I can't see the point of, you know, taking those out of the equation. But so this is a film very much from behind the battle lines in the West Bank, and from this set of villages in which Basel Adra has spent his life and grown up. And he's documenting the very brutal policy of moving in, demolishing mm-hmm. homes. You know, there's a situation of one of the inhabitants of the region, their family ends up living in one of the local caves. They have to move everything, you know, TV and everything into this cave. What's even more disturbing is that the man from this family is shot in a protest later, becomes paralyzed, and, you know, is in this cave in a state of almost complete paralysis. I mean, it's very, very disturbing. And, you know, I mean, even if someone were to be a supporter of Israel, you know, in the general state of things, and particularly after the atrocities committed by Hamas, you know, you still have to keep asking the questions about Israel's current response. But the problem is also that the prehistory of that response is the behavior of the IDF and the you know, the government policies behind the IDF's actions, which are immensely disturbing. And this film, you know, maps those out very strongly and, you know, quite chillingly.
Yeah, and it does so in a way that feels driven by what's happening on the ground. And I find the way it's structured to be really effective. It's driven by a series of events, but it's edited in this, you know, really, it sounds weird to say, but like well-paced way that gives you a sense of the incremental manner and the brutal manner of the, you know, IDF's tactics, which are clearly meant to clear the area, but in a way that always seems just slightly below the level of, like, you know, an actual, you know, doing it all at once, you know.
There is a curious sort of dramatic thread or quasi-dramatic thread, which I didn't quite buy, but I think it's necessary to help get some of the ideas across and build in a sort of thinking process into the film, which is a series of, I think, semi-stage dialogues, mainly between Basel Adra and Yuval Abraham, where they're some of the time sitting in the car driving along and talking about what they're doing and whether it's working and how tired they're beginning to feel. And then someone else, who I believe is another of the directors, Hamdan Balal, who is Palestinian, then questions Yuval Abraham's motivations, and, you know, he finds himself, you know, regarded as something of a dilettante who kind of moves in and sort of embeds himself in the community, but presumably gets to go home to his own bed. And, you know, you're fine. You want to see the whole thing ended. You want to end the occupation in 10 days as a result of what you're doing. But, you know, it's a very clever element of thinking aloud. Loud that was during the film. I wasn't convinced that it worked, and it ends an element of artifice, but it's probably necessary.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's part of what I actually liked, as the collection of approaches, because otherwise you just kind of have one confrontation, another confrontation, that it kind of allows sort of necessary just kind of breathing and reflective space. I mean, there's also a bit of a narrative between the two. They start off kind of skeptical of one another. Well, I mean, especially Basel is skeptical of Yuval, is overeager and thinking everything's going to be solved. But they really develop a bond that only seems to grow closer as it goes on.
Well, it's kind of a bromance, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
It's a hard documentary bromance.
Yeah, but that's a movie that I hope people see. But it's kind of, you know, it's in a section that you'd kind of have to sift through to get to it. I don't think it actually even had a press screening per se. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's in a Panorama documentary. So that's No Other Land. And the title actually comes from...
It's what the woman, the middle-aged woman who is forced to live in the cave, says, "Where are we going to go? We have no other land."
Yeah, yeah. So that really hits home. So moving to another movie, actually it might be nice to just talk about another documentary also, just as a way of saying that clearly this year's festival is going to be kind of defined by its nonfiction, I have to say, because I keep coming back to nonfiction films. Architecton is from Viktor Kosakowski, who is here, say, 2020, I think, with Gunda, which I love. I love Gunda, about a pig or a bunch of pigs. And this is, I mean, almost self-consciously an inorganic focus for this one. It's about, I mean, visually, it's about rock, earth. Actually, I want to hear what your description of this movie would be, because I think we might have moved through it a little differently. But how would you describe
it? It's a sort of eco epic. It's a follow up in a sense, or as counterpart to his film Aquarella, which was about water in all its different forms. And this is essentially about stone, but also about building and architecture. And it starts with some extraordinary flyovers of destroyed cities in Ukraine. Later there are destroyed cities in Turkey as a result of the earthquakes there. And then it's about ruins from the classical world, mm-hmm. and those periods, Baalbek and elsewhere. And it also revolves around a series of episodes in which an Italian architect is overseeing the laying down of a circle of stones in his back garden. And that sequence, those sequences, actually, if you put them together, they're very odd interludes in the film. They reminded me strangely of Victor Orrithe's film, The Quince Tree Sun, where sort of nothing terribly interesting is happening ostensibly, but it acquires great symbolic importance. But one of the extraordinary things about the film, and you know, I hate to use the term immersive, it's really over here, but it really is, and you are being bombarded with some extraordinary imagery, including slow motion displays of rock falls or falling rocks in quarries, and these sort of huge, sort of explosive sprays of boulders and pebbles and dust, shot very, very beautifully and precisely. The slow motion photography is extraordinary. I mean, it's completely immersive, and you just feel that you are having these mountains are just being kind of very slowly dumped on you,
buried alive.
It's astonishing visual material. One of the things that, you know, I did feel about the film, I mean, it's got, I think, a 90% extraordinary soundtrack of music that I think is taken largely from ECM recordings by a musician called Yevgeny Galperin. And I say 90% extraordinary because there are a couple of pieces in there that I think are quite horrible. But but most of it is wonderful, and it gives this film a real sort of monumental surge.
Yeah.
One of the things that slightly worries me about it is that as, let's say, immersive docu-poem, mm-hmm. in a kind of epic mode, it didn't sort of make me think slightly of Koyaanisqatsi.
Mm.
And it did begin to feel slightly kitsch to me, although I also thought to myself, well, you know, what is kitsch? Maybe we start calling things kitsch when we feel that they have achieved an extraordinary emotional impact, and we feel a bit embarrassed to admit it. So I am not embarrassed to admit that this film I found absolutely... I haven't seen any films here this year that merited that terrible phrase, shock and awe. But, I mean, there is a great sense of shock and awe to this film, and which is also trying to say something about human culture and the culture of architecture. And, you know, at the end, Kosakowski's asked two questions. You know, he's kind of interested in the problem of why we use all this concrete, why we're obsessed with using, but also he said, what's gone wrong with human culture? We came from a world in which buildings could last thousands of years, mm-hmm. and now we expect them only to last 40 or 50 years, mm-hmm. which actually is quite an interesting point in Berlin, you know, obviously a city which has been kind of architecturally has fallen and risen again, but actually the shopping center we're sitting just next door to in this kind of weird quasi futurist complex at Potsdamer Platz, the shopping center was closed for a couple of years because, being 30 years old, it was regarded as being obsolete and needed to be revamped. And
wow.
Something seems fundamentally wrong there. And I think Kosakowski makes that point very well.
Yeah. No, he's clearly very vexed by concrete because it sort of epitomizes a garbage in, garbage out approach to civilization, which I agree is a big, big problem. It's just that it's treating your life like it's disposable, you know.
And there's a lovely point that the architect makes at the end of the film. They have a sort of, there's no dialogue in the film except at the end when, there's a little bit, but at the end the main dialogue is between Kosakowski and this architect who admits to him that he's been working on a skyscraper in Milan and he feels deeply embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
Which I don't think his clients are going to like when they see the film, but I'm very glad he said it.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of great to hear that. I wish more architects would speak out like that. But yeah, this movie, I have to say, was daunting. I mean, it really does not let up. And I think, I checked my watch after the first, ended up being 20 minutes, just to see how long it had been, where you were just seeing, yeah, varieties of ruins and stone. I forget what happens at 20 minutes that I marked that point, but maybe that the first time the architect appears, maybe, or says something, because he's really grinding you under the dust. I mean, it's funny because there's a way the movie is pure cinema, you know, because it's just this pure like sensory overload, giving you kind of basically impossible perspectives, which is kind of showing you what cinema can be for, you know, showing you these close-ups of rubble where you would be buried alive if you were there, or showing you explosions. We were just talking about this, where he knows the explosion is going to happen, I guess, or it's a detonation like in a mine or something, but he's moving when it happens, so it's not like the usual spectacular view you have of a demolition where you're there to enjoy it. You're actually like thrust by it, and all these different ways of showing upheaval, which then kind of ties into this idea of civilization as a series of ruins, you know, this constant Ozymandias kind of thing.
Yeah, there's also a sort of wonderful thing going on in the, all the way through, there's a little thread in which someone who seems to be part of a construction project is balancing rocks on each other in an impossible way, like a huge stone on top of a tiny stone, and making them stand still.
Yeah.
Which seems to be some metaphor, not just, you know, for you know, the delicacy of culture, but precariousness, but also something about the process of filmmaking itself, that you have to get sort of the balance right.
Yeah.
But it's done in a very kind of witty and quite awe-inspiring way. You see, wow, how did they do this?
Right.
And it's wonderful, you know, we have to be reminded. You know, we were talking about the Bruno Dumont film earlier in the week, which is just a kind of ridiculous sort of CGI overload. And when you see things in films that are real and done for real and actually aspire to put stone-like chunks of the real directly in your lap.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful and in some ways, I think, a heroic thing.
No, and there's a way in which he also is rescuing some of this imagery from, like, the consumptive approach of a Planet Earth kind of series, you know, where you're hovering next to, like, volcanoes and whatnot. But that brings me back to what you were saying about Kitsch and whether that's a defense mechanism, because you do have the feeling that he's doing something different. And it's not even... I wouldn't say it's even something sublime necessarily with all this rock, but it's definitely unnerving in its own way. I don't know what I would call it. But yeah, even as I'm talking about it, I'm kind of digging myself out of where I was when I first saw it, which was I definitely felt like buried alive. But maybe that's kind of the point. Mm. And also, yeah, I just to reiterate, it does have like scenes from Ukraine and just lingering on the extent of destruction there and elsewhere, which I think is really kind of important because, again, when you see those in movies, it's often as like an establishing shot. In a way, like this is all establishing shots. It's like all the foundation that surrounds you, the built environment and the destroyed environment. And that's also disorienting, I guess.
It did make me think of something. You know, I was worried about those scenes at the beginning. And I remember, I wasn't here at the time, but it's become a famous event since, that whenever it was that Werner Herzog presented his film Lessons of Darkness here, which was about the oil wells on fire during the Gulf War, there was an outcry here. Apparently people were yelling at the screen at the idea that he was somehow aestheticizing this monstrous event. And that was certainly not the case in the press screening this morning. I didn't get any sense of anyone objecting to those scenes of Ukraine shot, I'm afraid, you know, very beautifully. So is it a problem? I don't know. Maybe people don't worry about that anymore. But it's an interesting thing because it did concern me. And I think Kosakowski has dealt with that. And of course, it's an important thing for a Russian filmmaker. Mm. Of course, he's been outside Russia for a long time. But for a Russian filmmaker to make, you know, to show how things have become in Ukraine.
It is huge, and it actually reminds me, I did an interview with Sergei Loznitsa, and I was, or, you know, I asked, like, how did you first learn that the war was starting or something? And I don't know if it was that this is how he learned, but he said he got a call from Viktor Kosakowski, his friend, just to talk to him about it, I guess, and also to apologize, which is, that was incredible. So, yeah, that is also very significant. Yeah, I felt like people were sort of cowed at the end, maybe because it is an overwhelming movie. Yeah, and there's also other bits of experimentation we didn't mention where, like, he switches to black and white to certain sequences.
With these strange kind of bleached out effects, yeah. So that you see these ancient ruins covered in foliage. In fact, there's an old village which seems to have been completely overtaken by the vegetation, which somehow the leaves come across as white. But it's beautifully shot, but strange.
It is, and that makes me think, like, is this so defamiliarized to me that's what's overwhelming me? Because it's not a type of, like, parched black and white that I've seen before, the particular way he's doing it. So that's, bold move.
And the DOP is someone called Ben Bernhard, who I'd never come across before. Yeah. In fact, Ben Bernhard, I believe, shot Aquarella as well, which would make sense.
So, yeah, that's my food for thought on Architecton from Viktor Kosakowski, who, also bears mentioning, I think, does think a lot about reflecting back at you, what you're doing as a spectator. I mean, that runs through a lot of his films, thinking about your perspective. So let's talk about perhaps a couple films from earlier in the festival that actually, for the press at least, were shown back to back. And it was a full meal that night. One is La Cocina, which is from Alonso Ruiz Palacios, who you might know from Museo and A Cop Movie, which is actually on Netflix. So you can just watch it. It's one of those movies where I'm like, oh yeah, this, you know, pretty adventuresome movie is right there on Netflix, along with, like, you know, that weird Charlie Kaufman movie. So yeah, this is a movie set mostly, if not entirely, in a restaurant in Times Square in New York. It's there and maybe the alley outside and maybe on the way there, because it opens with following a young woman as she's going to apply for a job there, and rather to claim a job that she says that she has reserved for her. That's just the way into it, and then you never really leave. But I'm really curious to hear what you thought about this, because I think I kept changing my mind while watching this movie, what I thought of it, and eventually felt like I was on a carousel and was thrown off by the end, because it's, you know, it's pretty much full on for most of the movie. To a certain extent, you're with Rooney Mara, who plays one of the waitstaff at the restaurant, who is having an affair with one of the chefs. And, you know, there's partly this boiler room atmosphere. At other times, you know, you see they're kind of bonding and they're fighting among each other. You know, there's issues of, like, race and class that come into things. So that's woven into it. You get into, like, the hierarchy of the chef who runs the restaurant and then the owner of the restaurant who descends now and again in his suit. But yeah, this is a movie I kind of liked how it was swinging for the fences and what it did. I don't know if I ended up entirely being with it, but sometimes I like a big splashy, like, attempt like this than not. But what did you make of it, Jonathan?
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I've always liked Alonso Ruiz Palacios, who I think is, you know, just a very, very exciting director. He always invents a particular style for his films, starting with the first one, Gueros, followed by a film that's really underrated that knocked me out when I saw it here, Museo, which is a kind of heist movie about pre-Columbian artifacts and, you know, where they are in, you know, the contemporary cultural world. And then an amazing film, the one you mentioned, which is basically a docudrama about cops. And it's a docudrama in the sense that it's done as a documentary and it's done as a drama, and the two kind of are interwoven. So one of the main actors from that, Raul Briones, is in La Cocina. And the key thing about La Cocina, interestingly, it's based on a British play by Arnold Wesker set in London, and it's updated and adapted. Wesker was very much about the Jewish experience, particularly in London, the Jewish immigrant experience. And I can't really remember the play terribly well, but I suspect that it's that factor that Ruiz Palacios has adapted. And it's very much about Mexican and other immigrants, people from a multi-ethnic working class background, working in New York and dealing with this problem of being in America. And at some point, one of the Latino staff who's well established and very much part of the establishment,
yeah,
says, "I'm American." And then the Briones character says, "What is America? There's no such thing." And it's about that. And it's about the Briones character, this particular cook, as an outsider, and his relationship with the waitress played by Rooney Mara. There's an extraordinary moment. There's a kind of pause in this very, very frenzied film.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are times when this film, set in this big kind of factory of the kitchen, it makes the bear look like a kind of tender little cub. It makes boiling point look like a gentle simmer. But it's not about the food, it's about the industry of food preparation, mm-hmm, and the system that kind of crushes people, keeps them hanging on. You know, the owner says to him, you know, I'll make sure that, you know, you work well, I'll make sure that you get residence papers. And of course, you know, it's just kind of a come on, everyone's had this.
Yeah.
But there's an amazing moment, a kind of quiet moment at the center of the film, where one of the staff members, a black man called Nonzo, played by Motel Foster, gives an extraordinary monologue in which he tells a story about a Neapolitan immigrant and a ray of green light. And you think, wow, where's this story going? What's it really about?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really know what it's about. But then later in the film, Ruiz Palacios picks up this theme in a brilliant visual flourish. The film's in black and white with very telling touches of character. It's fantastically shot. The DOP is Juan Pablo Ramirez.
Okay.
And I think it's mesmerizing, incredibly energetic work. It goes kind of off the rails at the end of the film, but it goes off the rails when one of the characters does. And it's, I mean, the choreography, both in terms of this very big cast and the camera,
is quite
extraordinary. And it's very much a theatrical feat. You know, you can see that it's using its theatrical origins.
Yep.
And I think the thing about the original Wesker play, which, if I remember right, was done at the Royal Court in London, it may be wrong, but I think the whole thing about it is people were seeing the work of a kitchen, a very heavily populated kitchen, happen on the stage in front of them. And I think it really came across as a shock. It was like taking what they call kitchen sink drama to the to the ultimate level. And you know, you really get the sense here that you are in the engine room, indeed, that you are in the belly of the beast, that people are preparing food but they're themselves being devoured by the system.
I can't really improve upon that. That's exactly how it feels. And with the choreography, I mean, I did think during the movie, this is kind of like a musical without songs, because there is just different rhythms to the movie that keeps shifting and changing with the characters and everything. So yeah, that's La Cocina. I do want to talk about one more movie just quickly, also it could be like a kind of palate cleanser, and that's Cuckoo, which I seem to remember that you described as a kind of giallo.
It was an alpine giallo. I mean, it definitely had a streak of Dario Argento to it.
Yeah.
It lives up to its title. It is Cuckoo. It's completely balmy. And I think in some ways pretty bad, and yet it has a sort of swagger to it. It's about a teenager played by Hunter Schafer from Euphoria, who ends up with her father and his second wife and their child in this alpine resort, which is owned by a very sort of a smooth, sinister a wealthy guy played by Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey, who seems to be making a career of acting in German, because he was very good here a few years ago in, as a sort of sexy android in, a comedy called I'm Your Man, which is very good. He's nowhere near as good. I mean, he's just kind of weird in this, and everyone is weird and everything is weird. Yeah. And there is a woman in a raincoat who screams at people. Heaven knows what's going on in it. But I mean... But it really, the thing about it, it cuts to the chase. I mean, in a way, it's sort of all chase and it's all frenzy. But I was comparing it with a film that was in competition with Gael Garcia Bernal called Another End, where everything is explained to you in these kind of elaborate exposition. You know that science fiction isn't working when someone has to sit you down and explain the rules of the game. In this, I think... eventually you find out what's going on and why, but that doesn't really matter. I mean, essentially it's about people kind of looming at you out of the dark and making weird faces at you, and it's also about, you know, this kind of young woman whopping the patriarchy in a kind of generic sort of teenage rebel way. It's never boring.
Yeah, that's right, never boring. I mean, I like the comparison to, like, Argento, just because it feels like, they don't have to explain things. The less explained, the better. You're even kind of charmed when things don't make sense, in a way, you know. But also because fear isn't necessarily logical, you know. So, you know, you'll have these sequences where something's happening that you don't even understand till later what it was really going. You know, Hunter Schafer's character takes his bike ride at one point, and it's just a marvelous sequence of her being chased by something and only gradually being aware of it, and then that chase kind of continuing.
And there's a shootout, and there's a renegade cop, and there's, you know, I mean, what are you... it's got everything. None of it makes much sense.
No, there's a shootout that feels like a leftover scene from like a 90s cop movie or something. But one thing I want to single out is the sound design in the movie, which I thought is almost literally hypnotic. They're doing things with frequencies, and I think almost with frequencies that you aren't always in your consciousness, you know. I mean, I've noticed movies now sometimes use like subsonic, even movies you would not expect are using that.
Well, this is actually something that I think was pioneered by Gaspar Noé and Lucy Hadzi Halilovic, who would refer to this as le rumble. Okay. And they kind of very much made that part of the kind of, let's say, alt genre. This is, I'm thinking of people like, you know, that Belgian duo, Kate and Forzani. Mm-hmm. And this film is very much in that spirit as well. And one of the things particularly about it, not just the sound, but there's some very, very weird editing effects.
Yes.
Where things are kind of played over, like the film itself is sort of distorting and hiccuping in front of your eyes. And you're thinking, what exactly is happening here? And it's sort of explained, but it doesn't really matter. And there's something weird about these. There's a certain kind of, like a sort of secret race of people who can twitch their ears in a particular way.
Somehow it seems to be some sort of breeding experiment or something. But even, I mean, I could try to explain it, but it doesn't really matter. But yeah, I mean, the way that on a sonic level, it draws you in. I swear that I was hearing something for a while that then when one character is dispatched, I stopped hearing and I immediately felt tension leave me. I might have imagined that, but I sort of think it might have been related to something being done with the sound. Maybe someday I'll ask the director, Tilman Singer.
Who is a German filmmaker who made a film called Luz or Luth. Something also, Bold Strokes 2014, which is described as short experimental documentary.
Yeah. And the one last thing I'll say is that, I only because you mentioned the couple who makes the movies that are kind of very formally, you know, deconstructing giallo and another genre. This is fun. Cuckoo is fun. Kind of has like these funny little flirtatious sequences that could be in like a Jarmusch movie or something. You know, there's like this whole kind of hotel clerk scenario.
Oh, yeah. She plays the most bored hotel clerk in the world. Yeah. And then there's a sort of a seductive, mean, lean French woman who comes in and flirts with her. Yeah.
That is Cuckoo, which I think in the U.S. at least is going to be in theaters in the spring. It has a date. I don't remember it, but it exists. So we'll wrap it up there and hopefully make it through another batch of screenings. But Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you and goodbye.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.